Our first meeting for today will be a discourse by Brother Joe Miguez. He has chosen for the title of his talk, The Beasts of Revelation 13. The Beasts of Revelation 13. Brother Joe.
Thank you, Brother Jeff and Brother Joe. I should mention at the outset that I'm going to try to end about 5 minutes early this morning because at the end of this hour we'll be favored by a program by the children's Bible classes. Earlier this year I gave a discourse entitled The Beasts of Daniel 7 and Revelation 17, taken largely from a treatise by Brother Chester Sunbaum titled The Beast and His Image, written in 1948. In that paper, Brother Sunbaum also analyzed the beasts of Revelation 13 and drew comparisons between them and the beasts of Daniel 7 and also Revelation 17, the three chapters. So today I'd like to take up a consideration of Revelation 13 from Brother Sunbaum's paper and from Brother Russell's writings as well. As a quick overview of Revelation 13, verses 1 to 10 trace the development of the Catholic Church system from the beginning of the Gospel Age to the year 1799. Verses 11 to 13 describe the establishment of the church-state system of England from its beginnings in the 1530s during the reign of King Henry VIII. And verses 14 to 18 describe the formation of the Protestant Federation beginning in 1846 with the creation of the Evangelical Alliance. So now let's begin with part one of Revelation 13 by reading verses 1 and 2 and place ourselves in time early in the Gospel Age. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. The beast rose up out of the sea, or restless masses of people. History tells us that shortly after our Lord's first advent, in the beginning of the Gospel Age, the Roman Empire began to weaken under the attack by its enemies, particularly hordes of barbarians from the north. The once mighty and unified empire divided first into two, Western and Eastern Rome. Then Western Rome divided again and again, eventually into 10 ruling houses, pictured by the 10 horns on this beast. History dates the fall of the Roman Empire at 476 AD, but the divisions which led to the fall began 200 or 300 years earlier. And it was a time of unrest and instability among the people, like waters of a troubled sea, as they anxiously watched the empire collapse. Now picture yourself, as John, sitting on the shore watching this vision. First you see only the roiling sea, picturing the restless masses of people. What rises up out of the water first? The body of the beast or its heads? Well, only the heads, of course. The body rises up after the heads are out of the water. So initially John sees only the heads of this beast, the divided powers of the Roman Empire emerging in the first 3 centuries of the Gospel Age. But then the body of the beast rises up, unifying the heads into one creature. When did the body rise up to combine the divided heads? Well, a significant date in the history of the Roman Empire is 328 AD, when Emperor Constantine was converted to Christianity. So now, by this date, the beast had entirely risen up out of the sea. But the beast as yet had no power. Civil power still remained in the hands of the Caesars, but not for long. Another key time reference is given in verse 2, where it says, "The dragon gave to this beast his power and seat and great authority." When did this take place? Well, I think we can say in 539 AD, when the Emperor Justinian sent his army from Constantinople to Rome in order to drive the barbarian Ostrogoths away from the region and solidify the Pope's temporal power in Europe. 539 AD thus marks the date when the papal system took control of the remnants of the Western Roman Empire, and the dragon gave to the beast his seat and power and great authority. And to confirm our identification of this leopard-like beast as a counterfeit church-state system led by papal Rome, we have the description of the elements of this beast given in verse 2. Like a leopard, having feet like a bear, and the mouth of a lion, with names of blasphemy upon its heads. Recall now the beasts of Daniel chapter 7, picturing the four universal empires. Those beasts were a lion, a leopard, and a bear. Followed by the fourth beast, showing that this beast of Revelation 13 was the same as that fourth beast, specifically in the period of time when the little horn, speaking great swelling words against the saints, rose on that fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, picturing the same thing as the beast in Revelation 13, a counterfeit church-state system led by papal Rome, which encompassed all the world empires that had preceded it. So now we can synchronize the visions of the beasts in Daniel 7 and Revelation 13. And as we showed in our previous discourse, we can also synchronize with the scarlet-colored beast ridden by the woman in Revelation 17, likewise picturing a counterfeit church-state system led by papal Rome. Let's continue reading with verse 3. And I saw one of the heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. This particular image that I found on the internet, I don't think portrays any one of those heads wounded. And as we'll see later, it's healed. So I couldn't find quite exactly all the images I wanted, but this one served quite well. Verses 1 and 2 of Revelation 13 that we read earlier were a brief history of the beginning of the gospel age to the year 539 AD. But verse 3 jumps forward in time to the Protestant Reformation of the 1500s to give us one more identifying event so that there is no doubt as to what this beast represents. Beginning in 1517 with the work of Martin Luther, the sword of the Spirit of Truth was used to bring to light old truths, such as justification by faith, which had been hidden for centuries in the doctrine of the Mass. In Volume 3, pages 109 to 112, Brother Russell traces the promise and then the disappointment of this turn of historic events. Here's a short quote. Luther, the leading spirit of the Reformation, did not stop with one error, but attempted to throw out many others and nailed upon the church door at Wittenberg, October 31st, 1517, 95 theses, all of which were objections to the doctrines of papacy. But alas, the cleansing work so nobly and courageously commenced was too radical to be popular, and the friends and admirers of Luther and his associates conquered in a measure, overpowering them with policy, prudence, flatteries, and promises of help and success, provided their course were shaped according to the dictates of the wisdom of this world. Several of the German princes became ardent admirers of the bold reformers. These princes aided the reformers, and in return for the aid, they received from the reformers recognition of their kingly rights. Thus, the same kind of union between church and state, which had worked such injury to the truth before in papacy, was the snare by which the adversary impeded and obstructed the cleansing of the sanctuary so nobly begun. Reformation and cleansing for a time ceased, and instead of progressing with the cleansing, the reformers gave attention to organizing themselves and to revamping and repolishing many of the old papal dogmas at first so loudly condemned. Thus did Satan decoy the reformers into the very harlotry, union of church and state, which they had denounced in the Church of Rome. And thus the deadly wound which papacy had received for a time was healed. Revelation 13:3, end of quote. So Revelation 13, verses 1 through 3, give us major events in the history of the rise of papal Rome. Now verses 4 to 8 take a broad look at the nature and character of this counterfeit church-state system. And they worshiped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Verse 4 describes the power of the Holy Roman Empire in its heyday. And verses 5 to 7 call to mind the persecution of the true saints of God for 42 months. How long is 42 months? Well, 42 months times 30 days per prophetic month give us 1,260 days, the exact same period as the time, times, and half a time of papal supremacy written about in Daniel 7, verse 25. That is the dates 539 to 1799 A.D. But at the end of this time, the church class would be triumphant and the oppressor would be overthrown. Listen to Revelation 13, 9 and 10. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity, the beast, shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. And so as we sang in our opening hymn, Zion is and will be completely triumphant in the end. So with these words of Revelation 13, verses 1 to 10, the history of the counterfeit church-state system led by Papal Rome is portrayed in symbol, from its beginnings in the 1st and 2nd century, through its persecution of the saints in the Dark Ages, to the breaking of its power beginning in 1799, when the 1,260 days had ended. And the parallel passages in Daniel 7 once again helped us identify key symbols in Revelation 13, just as they helped us in our earlier analysis of Revelation 17. So that brings us to the second main division of Revelation 13, a portrayal of the rise of the church-state system of England, starting with verses 11 through 13. And I beheld another beast come up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. How do we conclude that this two-horned beast is the church-state system of England? Unfortunately, Daniel cannot help us here. He says nothing in his entire prophecy about this beast, although we'll get some help from him a little bit later. But where Daniel is silent, secular history speaks loudly and clearly. And for this portion of my discourse, I will draw heavily from three sources. The first, of course, as I mentioned before, is Brother Sunbaum's treatise, The Beast and His Image, which is now available online, along with other of his writings, at a website managed by the Portland Area Brethren. The URL is myburdenislightallword.org/Sunbaum, and you do need to type in the suffix Sunbaum. The second source is from the reprints, pages 321 and 5349, and there are others as well, and volume references, which I've already begun to read. And the third source is a book well known to some of you, The Church in History by B.K. Kuyper. I highly recommend it. The history of the church-state system of England begins during the reign of Henry VIII, who became king in 1509 at age 18. Henry famously had six wives, the first of whom was Catherine of Aragon, a devout Catholic from Spain's royal house, whom he married the same year he became king. Now, initially, Henry was a firm Catholic, as all of England was. In fact, Henry regarded Luther as a heretic and wrote a book against heretics entitled The Seven Sacraments in the year 1518. And for that service, the Pope bestowed upon Henry the title Defender of the Faith. Now, all kings greatly desired a son to succeed him to the throne. Indeed, two sons, an heir and a spare, was the minimum expected of all royal wives. But alas, Henry's wife Catherine bore him five children, four of whom died young, And the sole survivor was a daughter named Mary, born in 1516. So around 1529, Henry asked the Pope for a divorce so he could marry Anne Boleyn, a lady of the court who had caught his eye. The Pope refused this request, whereupon Henry decided to take matters into his own hands. In 1532, he fired the Catholic Cardinal Wolsey and replaced him with Thomas Cranmer as the first Archbishop of Canterbury. In 1533, Henry secretly married Anne Boleyn, who bore him a daughter, Elizabeth, later that same year. Soon after, Archbishop Cranmer declared Henry's first marriage to Catherine null and void. In 1534, Henry had Parliament pass a law called the Act of Supremacy, which decreed that the king, not the pope, the king was the supreme head of the church in England. Now, even at this date, Henry still regarded himself as a good Catholic. There was no Reformation at work in England, as it was in other countries. Henry was merely establishing his authority over the Catholic Church hierarchy in his home country of England. Indeed, Henry even had Parliament pass another law, the Law of Treason and Heresy, which stated that to hold any doctrines other than those of the Catholic Church was heresy. And further, here's the good part that Henry wanted, to refuse to acknowledge the king as the head of the church in England was treason. And then, in a stroke of political genius, Henry confiscated all the church's lands and buildings owned by the Pope and gave them to his friends and to the nobles. Getting back to Henry's personal life, he was unwilling to give Anne a second chance to bear him a son, and the marriage turned sour. So in 1536, he had Anne executed on a trumped-up charge of unfaithfulness. Henry then married his third wife, Jane Seymour, that same year, and she at last gave Henry the long-awaited heir, a son named Edward. Jane Seymour died shortly after giving birth. Now, this family history is important because it illuminates the origins of the Church of England. When Henry VIII died in 1547, England was still a Catholic country. Although Luther's teachings had gained some followers in the capital city of London, and also the southeastern part of the country, which lay closest to the continent of Europe. When Henry died, his son Edward became King Edward VI at age 9. Edward's uncle, the Duke of Somerset, who favored the Reformation more as a political revolt against Rome than as a doctrinal struggle, effectively ran the country while Edward was king. And so under Edward's reign, England separated itself from the Pope's authority, and the Episcopal Church developed its own hierarchy, ceremonies, and in a few instances, even its own doctrines. But it remained, in many ways, very much like the Catholic Church. Now, you might think the story of the rise of the Church of England ends here, with the Episcopal Church well established. But wait, it gets much more involved, and there is some scriptural significance. Edward died of tuberculosis after a short reign of 7 years at age 16 and without child to succeed him. The next ruler of England would be either Mary or Elizabeth, the first two daughters of Henry VIII. In a series of political machinations too detailed to go into here, Mary won out and had her rival for the crown, Elizabeth, imprisoned. Queen Mary I, the daughter of the spurned Catherine, a staunch Catholic, exacted her mother's revenge, undoing all the laws passed under Henry VIII's reign and his son Edward. England was once again Catholic. But Mary didn't stop there. She had almost 300 people who had supported the separation from Rome burned at the stake at Heretics, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had declared her mother's marriage to Henry null and void. And for this persecution, she earned the name Bloody Mary. Thankfully, Mary died after only 5 years as a queen and was succeeded by her sister, Elizabeth I, who undid everything Mary did and restored the Church of England to its separate status from the Church of Rome once again and for good. Elizabeth I ruled firmly but wisely for 45 years, guiding her country and her people through the difficult transition from Catholicism to Episcopalianism. She never married, realizing that if she married a Catholic man, it would alienate her Protestant subjects, and if she married a Protestant, it would offend her Catholic subjects. Her reign has been called the Golden Age because it was a time of great achievement in England, including the defeat of the Spanish Armada, as well as the literary careers of the famous playwright William Shakespeare and others. Elizabeth died in 1603 and was succeeded by her cousin, King James I, who, in a little bit of historical Bible trivia, is well appreciated by us Bible students, except perhaps by those of you who prefer the New American Standard. As we take one last look back on the rise of the Church of England, it is important to note that the Reformation in England was the work of the government, of kings and queens and wealthy people, those vying for power and political advantage, rather than a people's struggle for religious purity as it was in other countries. And this understanding will help us decipher Revelation 13. So let's put European history aside for now and return to Revelation 13, verses 11 to 13. In verse 11, it says, "This two-horned beast came up out of the earth." By contrast, the first beast came up out of the sea. Now, the sea, as we said, represents unstable masses of society, the lower classes, whereas the earth represents the more stable, wealthier classes. And, as our history lesson just showed, the Church of England was created or rose up not from the outcry of the common people, the restless masses, but from the desires of the king himself and from his friends and the nobles who acquired land and wealth formerly owned by the Pope. Verse 11 goes on to say, "This beast had two horns, representing the two countries Henry VIII ruled, England and Ireland. Indeed, this new church he created was called the Church of England and Ireland for 333 years, from 1538 to 1871. And the horns, as we read in Revelation 13, were described as horns like a lamb, picturing that England at this time was not a dominating, imperious, warlike nation as the empires that came before it were. But England was at relative peace with its neighbors. It expanded, but not at the expense of other countries. Lastly, verse 11 tells us this two-horned beast spake as a dragon. The dragon again refers to civil power as a whole, and the voice of the Church of England was the voice of the King of England, the civil power, the dragon. Verse 12 gives us more prophetic symbology that our history lesson explains. Verse 12 says that the two-horned beast exercised the power of the first beast and caused the earth and the people to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. What a perfect description of the Church of England in the 1530s. Martin Luther's Reformation beginning in 1517 was the deadly wound upon the first beast, the papal system. It was Henry VIII's law of treason and heresy which declared it to be heresy to hold any doctrine other than those of the Catholic Church. Thus did the Church of England, the two-horned beast, cause the people to worship the first beast, the Church of Rome. And verse 13 gives us more. It says, "The two-horned beast did great wonders. It made fire come down out of heaven in the sight of men." Now, when you think of Bible accounts of fire coming down out of heaven, you often think of God's righteous judgments upon the blasphemous. For example, Elijah and the prophets of Baal, who were destroyed by fire. But in Revelation 13, we see a counterfeit of the Elijahs and a counterfeit of God's righteous judgment. We see man's evil, corrupt judgment. We see Queen Mary I, the daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, calling for the burning at the stake in the public square, in the sight of men, 300 people who had led the new church away from the dictates of the Pope. The fire Bloody Mary called for came out of heaven, the ecclesiastical heaven of her day, in an attempt to undo what her father and half-brother Edward had done. But Bloody Mary did not succeed, and her successor Elizabeth secured the place of the two-horned beast in the pages of history and prophecy. That brings us now to the third and last division of Revelation 13, verses 14 to 18, which foretell the rise of the Protestant Federation, symbolized by the image of the beast. Let's first read just one verse, Revelation 13, 14. "And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live." So what is this new beast, the image of the first beast? Let's analyze verse 14 closely. It begins by saying that the two-horned beast, that's what we're still talking about in the context of the previous verse where we left off, verse 13, the two-horned beast deceived the people by performing miracles in the sight of the first beast. What were the miracles the two-horned beast performed, and what does "in the sight of the beast" mean? Again, in Brother Sonnenbaum's 1948 treatise and in reprint page 321, they suggest that the miracles and wonders the two-horned beast, the church-state system of England and Ireland, performed was to set up itself as a copy of the church-state system of papal Rome, making deceitful decrees and pronouncements, persecuting heretics, and so on. And the church-state system of England and Ireland did this not secretly or quietly, but in the sight of, in the full view of, the papal church-state system. And miraculously, they got away with it. The papal beast, wounded by the Reformation, could not bring its full strength to bear against Henry VIII and stop him from setting up his own church-state system. Now, in the middle of verse 14, the prophecy jumps forward in time about 300 years to the year 1846. And this is where the two-horned beast deceives them to dwell on the earth once again, saying, "Make an image of the beast." Brother Russell's explanation of this part of verse 14 in the foreword of volume 4 is excellent. The question arises now, why should the scriptures picture Protestantism as an image of the beast? When and how did this come about? From the time of the Reformation, Protestants had been striving individually to get out of the darkness of the past, and thus had formulated many creeds and had organized many denominations. But about the middle of the last century, the leaders began to see that if everyone continued to study the Bible individually, the time would come when each one would have an individual creed. To prevent what seemed to them a loss of power, they planned a union of Protestants in a system called the Evangelical Alliance. The Evangelical Alliance, an organization of the different Protestant denominations, was formed in 1846 for the very purpose of doing in their own way the same thing that Catholicism would do in its own way, seeing the great power that Roman Catholics would exercise because of a united system. Protestants said, "We are divided. We have no power. We will organize." Then and there, according to the scriptures, they made an image of the beast. And history records that in 1846, Christians from 10 countries, 800 representatives in all, met for the purpose of launching, in their own words, this is what they said, a new thing in church history, a definite organization for the expression of unity among Christian individuals belonging to different churches. They formed an organization called the Evangelical Alliance. Oh, and the city where this historic and prophetically significant meeting took place was London, England, the seat of power of the two-horned beast. Once again, we can turn back to the book of Daniel for assistance in identifying this image of the beast. In chapter 8, we read about Daniel's vision of a he-goat picturing the Roman Empire once again, just like the fourth beast in Daniel chapter 7. And like the fourth beast, the he-goat grows a horn which magnifies itself against the true saints of God. And in Daniel 8, verses 11 to 14, I won't read them exactly. You can speed read while it's on the screen if you like. But it talks about how this persecution of the saints was to continue until 2,300 days, or this defiling of the sanctuary, and then the sanctuary would be cleansed. Now, none of the animals in Daniel 8 point to the image of the beast in Revelation 13, but this prophecy of the 2,300 days does. And I won't go into details. You can read them in Volume 3, the chapter on the cleansing of the sanctuary, but I will read a part of that chapter from Volume 3, page 119. Thus, AD 1846, the end of the 2,300 days, as above shown, found an unorganized nucleus of Christians who not only agreed with the disciples regarding simplicity of church government, the discarding of all creeds but the Bible, and the abolition of all titles by its ministers, but with the Baptists relative to the outward form of baptism, and with Luther in regarding the papal system as the man of sin and the degenerate church, the mother of harlots and abominations. These, standing aloof from any compromise or affinity with the world, taught vital piety, simple trust in the omnipotent God, and faith in his unchangeable decrees. And in addition, while recognizing Christ as Lord of all and now partaker of the divine nature, they regarded against the unscriptural as well as the unreasonable theory that Jehovah is his own son and our Lord Jesus is his own father. And they began to see that eternal life and immortality are not present possessions, but are to be expected only as gifts of God through Christ and the resurrection. Continuing, it as though God would arrange that thereafter there should always be a class representing his sanctuary cleansed at the end of these 2,300 days in the year 1846, kept separate from the various sects, this very year, 1846, witnessed the organization of Protestant sects into one great system called the Evangelical Alliance. This organization, mindful of the new views of the cleansed sanctuary, clearly defined its faith in human immortality, adding it as the ninth article of its creed. Thus it separated and has since kept separate from other Christians a company of God's children, the Lord's cleansed sanctuary, a sanctuary of truth. And to this cleansed sanctuary class, other meek and faithful children of God have been added daily ever since. End of quote. Note that the Evangelical Alliance was not the cleansed sanctuary class. Quite the opposite. The cleansed sanctuary class was the unorganized nucleus of simple, humble students of the Word. The Evangelical Alliance stood out in contrast as a united, international system with its own articles of creed, a fitting image of the fourth beast with its little horn. And so Daniel chapter 8 gives us a confirmation that the Evangelical Alliance, formed at the end of the 2,300 days in the year 1846, is pictured by the image of the beast in Revelation 13. Now, this new beast in Revelation 13, this image, was a very precise and accurate image of the first beast in several important ways. One was its gradual formation. Recall how we said earlier that the first beast rose gradually out of the sea from its small beginnings over a period of 500 years or so before the dragon gave his power and seat and authority to the leopard-like beast in 539 AD. Likewise, this image had a small beginning in 1846, but it has been growing ever since. Here are some milestones in the history and growth and development of the Evangelical Alliance and Church Union. In 1908, the Federal Council of Churches in America was formed. In 1943, the National Association of Evangelicals was created. In 1944, the American Council of Christian Churches came into existence. And in 1950, the National Council of the Churches of Christ in the USA. Outside the USA, we have seen in 1910, the International Missionary Conference in Stockholm, which led to the 1925 World Conference on Life and Work and the 1927 World Conference on Faith and Order. These last two conferences met again in 1937 and called for the creation of a new organization. And in 1948, the World Council of Churches emerged. And let's not forget the Second Vatican Council, held intermittently from 1962 to 1965, at which Protestant observers were even invited to attend. So the image of the beast has been slowly, gradually fashioned and is now nearly complete, if not entirely so. But there was one more momentous event foretold. So let us read the end of the prophecy in Revelation 13, verses 15 to 18. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. and his number is 603. Well, we've arrived at the controversial part of this chapter. It describes the rise to heavy-handed power of this image of the beast after it is given life by the two-horned beast. What does this mean? When does it apply? Let's start with Brother Russell's expectation, then Brother Sunbaum's. In the 1912 foreword to Volume 4, we studied these pages just a few weeks ago, we read, "The Bible says that, however, before the image can do any particular harm, it must receive life from the two-horned beast. Although the Evangelical Alliance was organized in 1846, it has not been able to accomplish its purpose because it did not know how to operate. The denominations in the Alliance were united only in name and hence have worked against each other. As a result, the image had no power to act. It was trodden upon, and to get vitality, life, it would need apostolic succession. It must have something as a basis for operation. The scriptures indicate that the Church of England will become intimate with the Evangelical Alliance and will give it apostolic authority to preach. Because of this union, the Alliance will be able to say, 'We have apostolic authority to preach. Let no one speak unless he has our sanction.' This action on their part is described in Revelation 13:17. None will be allowed to buy or sell spiritual things in the spiritual market unless he has either the mark of the beast or the mark of the image." A year later, in November of 1913, Brother Russell wrote this on reprint page 5349. "The vitality of the image is to come from the two-horned beast, that is, the Church of England. We have been waiting for this consummation more than 30 years and have seen it draw nearer and nearer. A few years ago, the Episcopal Church took an important step toward vitalizing the Church Federation movement, which it is favoring and backing. That important step was the recognition of the ministers of the denominations represented in the Evangelical Alliance. Previously, no minister not ordained by the laying on of hands of a Catholic or an Episcopalian bishop was allowed to preach from an Episcopalian pulpit. Perhaps this recognition of the image is all the vitalization the image needs. But we are inclined to expect more. For years, the Episcopalians have proffered reordination to the ministers of the different denominations represented in the Evangelical Alliance, and they still proffer it. We have been inclined to expect that the ministers would finally concede the point and accept a reordination at the hands of an Episcopal bishop. But we are not sure of this. It is possible that, to meet the requirements of the case, some other way will be found by which the Episcopal Church will recognize the Church Federation without obligating the ministers to be reordained. We are waiting for this." Then Brother Russell goes on to explain his understanding of the chapter, saying that once the image is vitalized, it will punish and persecute the true saints. None will be allowed to buy or sell in the spiritual marts except those who have the mark of the beast or the number of his name. 35 years later, in 1948, Brother Sunbaum, in his treatise, The Beast and His Image, essentially said, "We are still waiting for the same things to happen that Brother Russell looked forward to in 1913, and that when the image was vitalized, it would symbolically kill the true saints of God through an enforced cessation of the true Christian's work." The controversial question, of course, is the fulfillment of Revelation 13, 15 to 18 now in the past, or is it still future today? Do we still look forward to its fulfillment? Most Bible students say, yes, it is still future, and that is my view as well. However, some diligent and knowledgeable brethren see the fulfillment of these verses in the past, during World War II in Europe. They argue, and with some merit, that freedom of the press and personal liberty to worship as we please are so much stronger today, especially in the United States, that it is unlikely that such freedoms could be rescinded as Revelation 13 and 15 to 18 seem to prophesy. As we look out the window at the current state of things, can we really expect such dire events to come to pass? This is the view of those who see the fulfillment of these verses in the past. Here's my thought. Like many things in symbolic prophecy, the fulfillment is often a series of events over a long period of time. Sometimes we can mark a very specific date pointed out in the scriptures, such as 328 or 539 or 1846. But the progress of events before and after that one specific date marked out in the scriptures is a part of the total fulfillment of the prophecy as well. Brother Russell said exactly this regarding the image of the beast. Its formation was gradual, and its receiving life had a small beginning in 1913. But as he said, we are inclined to expect more. Brethren, I am inclined to expect more. Future from today. But I have to keep reminding myself that the fulfillment I expect may not be as prominently told in the news media as I would like. Sometimes I expect to open a newspaper one morning and see the headline read, "Image of the Beast Vitalized." And the copy would say, "Yesterday in London, the Archbishop of Canterbury gave life to the image of the beast, while in the U.S., the President announced the formation of a church-state union. Persecution of the true saints to begin tomorrow at noon, starting with the Chicago Bible students." Most likely, the evidences of prophetic fulfillment will be more subtle, like the one Brother Russell took note of in reprint 5349. And in that vein of subtle fulfillment that we must closely watch for, is something I found on the website of the Evangelical Alliance. They have a website, by the way. EEA and the EU, looking toward a better Europe. The dateline is October 21st of this year. Evangelicals in Europe have traditionally veered away from political involvement, focusing instead on a networking within churches and nurturing individual spiritual growth. However, with the establishment of a new European Evangelical Alliance office near the European Union institutions in Brussels and the selection of a new EEA Brussels representative, evangelicals are taking a step forward in their commitment to transform Europe through political, social, and economic means. We are here to win souls, but we are also here to transform Europe with a holistic mission, said Leonardo Di Chirico, the vice president of the Italian Evangelical Alliance, during the public policy session of the EEA's 2005 assembly on Thursday. There is a political dynamic attached to this holistic mission. So now here's something interesting to consider as we watch for the fulfillment of prophecy. If you talk to our brethren in Europe, you know, everybody sees fulfillment of prophecy in their own country, in their own time. If you talk to our brethren in Europe, they see the EU, the European Union, as the 10 horns on the beast of Revelation 17, when it arises up out of the abyss. And as we've seen, the beast of Revelation 17 is the same as the first beast of Revelation 13, the leopard-like beast. Now, if the Evangelical Alliance is the image of the first beast, and if it is already at work in cooperation with the beast, the EU, in Brussels, Belgium, as we just read from the internet, well, maybe we're further along than we thought. But as Brother Russell said, I am inclined to expect more. However, what more may come may not be posted on a website or printed in the newspaper. You know, I truly believe that there are many hidden secret maneuverings and negotiations going on between the powerful elite in the churches and the powerful elite in the civil governments that may never come to light until the kingdom. So let us be watchful, and let us not expect too much to be announced in the evening news. The complete fulfillment of Revelation 13, 15 to 18, when it does come, and I believe it is yet future, may be less dramatic than some of us expected, and yet more than others of us thought possible, especially in this country. But it will be exactly as God designed, and some of it may already be behind us. And let us not fall into the trap of living only in the future, focusing our attention on what persecutions we expect to come and emotionally preparing ourselves so that we will be ready to endure this one great final test. If we think only of withstanding that one great final test, we may overlook smaller opportunities for sacrifice today. It is in the daily little things of our consecration that we will make our calling and election sure. So let us live not in the future, spending all our time today preparing for it. Neither let us live in the past, reliving its sorrows or its pleasures. Brethren, live in the present. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. All we have is today, and it's a gift from God. That's why we call it the present. Let me close with these thoughts and three final questions. The study of Revelation 13 is mostly an intellectual exercise, all head and no heart. We study to answer questions like, what do those symbols mean? When do they apply? When is their fulfillment, past or future? But I'd like to suggest this important lesson for the heart in Revelation 13, 17. It said that no man could buy or sell, that is, in the marketplace of religious ideas, meaning trading in the knowledge of God, witnessing to God's great character and his wonderful plan, unless they had the mark of the beast or the number of his name. Now, you're familiar with how Brother Russell and Brother Sonbaum also explained the number of his name as being 666, the Roman numeral equivalents of the Latin title Vicar of Christ on the papal crown. And as to who has the number of his name and who has the mark, Brother Sonbaum draws this distinction on pages 16 to 18 of his treatise, and I'm paraphrasing here. Those who have the number of his name are the lesser dignitaries of the Roman Catholic Church, including the local priests. Now, by contrast, listen to what he says about those who have the mark. Those who have the mark are people of all classes, small and great, free and bond. The mark means characteristics of the beast, and they support the beast and its activities. Now, those who have the characteristics of the beast have his mark. What are the characteristics of the vast number of nominal Christian supporters of the beast? Here are a few of those marks. The mark in the forehead, a lack of interest in personally studying the Bible to come to an understanding of it. Instead of personal study, there is an uncritical acceptance of the creeds of the denomination. The mark in the right hand, a lack of commitment to attend church services, or else a willingness to attend merely for the social interaction rather than for spiritual uplift and edification. Also, no spirit of sacrifice. Instead, a Christian life when it is convenient and doesn't interfere with satisfying self. And there are more examples of these marks that we lump together with the term nominal Christian. A Christian in name only. I'd like to suggest that beneath all the symbols in Revelation 13, as well as in other chapters, most notably the message to Laodicea, we have a strong underlying message for our hearts. A warning to us, the true followers of Christ, to avoid having the qualities that God hates in those who claim to be his children but are not. To avoid having even a hint of the mark or characteristics of the beast. By contrast, the true followers of Christ have these marks or characteristics. The seal of the Holy Spirit and his Father's name written in their foreheads. They, in the picture of the tabernacle priesthood, have the blood of sacrifice on their right ear, right hand, and right foot. So here are my final three questions. Is it possible for us to become nominal Bible students? Second, what is that mark in your forehead and in your right hand? Is it faint and barely legible, or is it clearly and boldly drawn?